Can you think of anything else?
I'm glad other people don't remember. That's all I can say. Okay, here we go.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, the growing epidemic of female drinking. A new mom recounts her harrowing story.
Then, this actress has worked with Alfred Hitchcock and some very unruly birds. Got any clues on who we'll be talking with?
Next, we'll chat about Edgar Allan Poe and some little-known facts about Abraham Lincoln.
Plus, a mysterious way to travel, where the suspense is part of the fun.
And we'll shoot the breeze with an entrepreneur who had an itch.
According to the Center for Disease Control, American women are drinking more often than ever and in ever larger quantities. In fact, 1 in 8 women report indulging in binge drinking on a regular basis. And contrary to what we see on television, these women are not only young, unattached women who are driving the statistics, they are often moms taking care of small kids.
In Drunk Mom, a memoir, journalist Jovita Bidlowska tells the brutally honest story of her alcoholism while a mother of a young child and her fight and ultimate triumph over a debilitating dependence. Jovita joins us on the phone from New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you were painfully honest and detailed about your struggle with alcohol. I mean, you sure did not sugarcoat your experience, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But give us some background. Before we delve into your story, did you have problems with alcohol before you became a mom?
Certainly. I became sober at the age of 27, and because I did have a problem with alcohol and I identified as an alcoholic. And I stayed sober for 3.5 years and had a relapse after the birth of my son.
And how did you get yourself sober the first time when you were 27?
I met someone who was attending 12-step meetings, so that was my encounter with sobriety, and that's all I knew about how to get sober in the beginning.
Well, Jovita, when you were pregnant, were you actually drinking?
No.
That's good. Well, can you tell us about the relapse, you know, once your son was born? What
sure.
happened?
I knew I was an alcoholic the whole time, and I was sober, and to celebrate his birth, we had a party, and people came over with bottles of champagne and all kinds of, you know, gifts and things like that to celebrate. And during the party, someone handed me a glass of champagne, and I don't even remember thinking about it. I drank it. And what happens with, I don't know if all alcoholics, but definitely some alcoholics, is that, you know, once you have that first drink, it gives you permission to have another one and to go on from there.
Now, did the person that handed you that glass of champagne, did they know about your history?
I don't remember who it was, but I was pretty out about being an alcoholic. So, but, you know, it could have been someone who had no idea.
Okay, and then you have a partner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did he know that you were drinking again? Did he have any idea?
Certainly. I mean, he was aware quite early on because he did have to pick up slack, you know, when I was unable to take care of our son. But the thing about, you know, addicts or anyone with a dark secret is that we're really good at denying and lying. You know, addiction and drinking, for example, is one thing. But majority of the time is spent, you know, lying and trying to manipulate situations and people in order to cover up those lies.
Right. Did your friends know that you were drinking again? Because you talk about sort of concealing your
mm-hmm.
alcoholism.
The only people that knew were my partner and my sister. And to the outside world, I was perfectly behaved, you know, urban mom with a new baby, well-dressed, well-taken care of. And that was also part of a lie, you know, that I've made up about this whole situation. I didn't mean to say made up, but you know what I mean.
Right, right. Well, did you worry? I mean, here you are, a mother with a young son, and, you know, you probably, I mean, you had a partner, but legally you weren't, you know, together. Did you ever worry that if somebody knew your secret, like your child might be taken away from you?
Certainly. Near the end of my drinking that time, it became so desperate and so dark for me that, you know, that was one of the things that crossed my mind. What came along with that was also this idea that because I was such a, you know, terrible mother, I needed to remove myself from the situation. I didn't have an idea how to do this, but, you know, thoughts like, you know, crossing the street a little too early or you know, just running away from home like a teenager. I had all these dark thoughts because I knew I was, you know, destroying him and destroying our relationship. And I was absolutely heartbroken, and I couldn't get better. I couldn't get sober. And I wanted to desperately.
Well, Jovita, you just mentioned that towards the end, it was a very dark place for you. Mm-hmm. What was your darkest moment?
Oh, that's a good question. My darkest moment was probably imagining the worst. And that was, you know, something happening to my son. In the same thought, you know, knowing that there was nothing I could do, I was in total despair. And knowing that I was definitely going to die from this condition, he may not, but, you know, just living with this constant cycle of guilt and remorse and drinking and guilt and remorse and drinking. There were a lot of dark moments.
You also said that you went to great lengths, you know, to conceal your drinking, which you really describe in cringeworthy detail. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what you did? How did you hide it?
Nothing extremely creative, but I mean, and you know, in my closet, I had some bottles up on the deck, you know, and plants. And I carried alcohol in a diaper bag. I'm still, you know, very ashamed to admitting to that, but I talk about it in the books. At the same time, I also had bottles of formula in a diaper bag because I knew I wouldn't be able to breastfeed. So my son had a lot of formula during the moments, you know, where I was unable to breastfeed him. And I disposed of empty bottles all the time. So it's not even the hiding of the bottles that I remember the most. The disposing of them is probably what sticks out in my mind the most. And the constant, you know, worrying about being caught and not getting caught and feeling like I got away with it.
Can you give us some insight why alcohol won even over your own child? I mean, that's such a prime instinct, you know, to be protective of your children. How did alcohol win?
I think ultimately at the end, you know, it was the love for my child that won. But you're right, in that first year, how did alcohol win? You know, I was predisposed to addiction because I was an alcoholic and I was sober before, and I knew I had this problem. I say in a book, I love my son from the first ultrasound. I was so devoted to him before he was even born, and I had this fantasy about what it was going to be like. And when he was born, it was a very joyous moment. I've never felt love and euphoria as such ever before in my life. But also what came with my motherhood, and I think it's the case for many new parents, was this extreme isolation and this idea that I actually had no idea what to do, how to be a mom. I knew it, you know, from books, and I saw it on television, and I had some instincts about it, but it felt absolutely overwhelming and very isolating and very dark. Combine that with my relapse, that's what ended up happening. And the whole time, you know, I loved my son very much, and I wanted him to win, and he did in the end.
And then, you know, most of us can't really understand what it's like to be an addict. Can you take us inside your head to sort of crave something more than even your own child? What is that like?
I'm glad you used the word craving. It's almost like an animal-like instinct. It's almost like a switch going off in your brain that once you start drinking or whatever your other addiction is, it's impossible to stop. And then you have to, you know, and then you end up drinking because you feel guilty about drinking. And you also are very much in denial to the outside world, but also to yourself. I mean, nobody really wants to admit to being an alcoholic. Nobody wants to admit to, you know, being a terrible mother who drinks instead of, you know, trying to get better. But I mean, it's not like I didn't try to get better. It's just I simply could not. I mean, alcoholism is referred to as disease in some circles, you know. It's referred to as spiritual condition. It is one of those things that doesn't have, I don't think, general definition, but it's certainly something that kills a lot of people. And that what I think kills more than actual addiction is not talking about it and stigmatizing it and keeping it behind closed doors. I'm very glad you're talking about it and you're asking me about it because I think that gives us opportunity to open some of those doors and, you know, to give people hope. I am sober today, and I have been for 4 years, so you can't get sober, you can't get better.
Our guest is Jovita Bidlowska, journalist and author of a brutally honest book called Drunk Mom, a memoir. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Jovita Bidlowska about her harrowing memoir of motherhood in the shadow of alcoholism. Jovita, what caused you really to hit rock bottom? And what was that experience like?
Mm-hmm. My rock bottom was pretty uneventful. What happened is I got to the point in my life, you know, it was just a regular day, early morning, and I was going for a walk with my son in a stroller after a night of drinking, unfortunately. And I got to the point where I thought of two options. Option number one was to continue living the way I was living and continue with the lies and, you know, go back home and lie to my partner and try to, you know, con everyone about what was going on. Or option number two was to admit what was going on, stop lying, and suffer the possible consequences because, you know, the consequences could have been dire. I mean, my partner certainly wanted me to move out at that point. I was worried about, you know, were I to admit to what was going on, I was worried about possibly losing custody of my child. I was worried about all kinds of things, you know, losing my job, things like that. And that, becoming honest and stopping lying and suffering those possible consequences seemed like lesser of a burden than going on and doing what I was doing. So I had a very, very brief moment of clarity. And in that moment, I made a decision to suffer the possible consequences and become sober. And I immediately went to, you know, a 12-step meeting, and that's what happened.
Wow. Well, Jovita, you've also been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Is that under control now?
Certainly. And that's something that, you know, I found out about after I was sober. So I still had some struggles, and I had a wonderful doctor who, you know, sat down and talked with me. And that's something that, you know, was news to me. And I think a lot of the time, other issues may be masked by, you know, addiction, alcoholism.
Right, because I would think that there would be a connection between sort of self-medicating with alcohol and your bipolar disorder.
Possibly.
Well, Jovita, you know, as you say, your book is brutally honest. And some parts are incredibly difficult to read. And you've actually been criticized of oversharing. How do you respond to those critics?
You know, I respond to any criticism or praise with the same reaction, which is that it's good to actually talk about this issue because I think that's what lies at the bottom of this issue is that, you know, my willingness to talk about it and to, you know, put a face and a name to something that's really dark and that people get stigmatized over. So is it oversharing? Possibly, but possibly we don't share enough and we don't talk enough about, you know, things that happen behind closed doors. And, you know, my story touches on alcoholism and addiction, but I know that, you know, people suffer from all kinds of other issues, especially new parents, like things like, you know, overeating or shopping or just feeling depressed, never leaving the house. Like all of those are issues that a new parent can suffer from because of this isolation and the lack of support. So I'm hoping, you know, even with criticism, we will open some doors.
Are you at all concerned about your son reading this book eventually and his opinion of what happened when he gets older?
Certainly. I mean, that's crossed my mind. I've told myself that, you know, I will be always willing to answer any questions that he may have. And I want to have this conversation with him when he's old enough to talk about the book and talk about, you know, the past and what happened. And it's not really up to me to know what, you know, to decide what his reaction is going to be. You know, it may be nothing and maybe all kinds of things. So I'm looking forward to it with some fear, certainly, but I'm looking forward to being honest with him and to being open with him and to talking about it.
And real quickly, have you heard from other moms and dads who perhaps have the same problem?
Tons, yes. I mean, when the book came out in Canada, I get emails all the time, you know, all the time from, and not just from parents who struggle with alcoholism, but also from people who grown up with, you know, parents who drank. So, you know, adult children of alcoholics. So yeah, it's a constant communication that I'm in with people who write to me. I think it's easy to confess to a stranger. So a lot of the time, you know, the emails just say, I read your book and I just wanted to tell you that I'm going through the same thing. That's it.
Jovita, is it a daily struggle to stay sober? I mean, do you still get cravings for alcohol?
Not at all. It's not a struggle to stay sober at all. I have routines. I know myself. I'm trying to always be honest with myself. I know what sort of warning signs to look out for. I don't think about alcohol at all. Maybe once in a while, but not in any obsessive way.
Like, are you able to go to bars and be with people that are drinking quite a bit?
Sure, but I always have to ask myself, what is the point of me, going to a bar? Do I really have a reason to be in a bar? I mean, if the reason is not really sufficient enough, then I don't go to a bar.
And are you and your partner still together?
Yes, we are.
So finally, Jovita, what do you hope really comes out of your book?
Well, like I said, I'm hoping that, people will read it and will be able to relate. And even if they cannot relate to it, I'm hoping that it will give some insight into the mind of, of an addict, into the cycle of thinking and what happens when someone's active in their addiction, because that's something that my loved ones were always asking me about. They were always saying, why are you this way? What's going on with you? Why can't you snap out of it? So I'm hoping that will give people insight into that particular issue. But I'm also hoping that, that will give people hope, because I'm here and I'm sober and I'm healthy. My family's healthy. My son is doing great. So it's possible to come out of it, even the darkest night.
Jovita Bidlavska, journalist and author of Drunk Mom, a Memoir, thanks so much for sharing your story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our next guest made her film debut in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds and then scored the title role in Marnie. This former fashion model, who was featured on the cover of Life magazine, has had a soaring and eclectic career. One of her most unique roles is that of den mother, yep, you heard me correctly, to 60-odd big cats, including a lion, tiger, leopard, and a cougar.
Tibby Hedren joins us from California to talk about her career and quest to build awareness about abandoned and abused exotic felines. Welcome, Tibby.
Thank you. Well, it's very nice to talk to you both.
Well, it's lovely to have you. And, Tippi, to this day, I remember the first time I watched The Birds. I was a little girl, mm-hmm. and I was with my mom and dad. And I'm telling you, I think I had nightmares for weeks.
Yes.
So, Tippi, how did you first meet Alfred Hitchcock, the King of Terror?
I was a fashion model in New York. It was during the 50s, and it was the advent of the television set. With the television came the television commercials, and I received a call from Universal Studios asking if I was the woman in this pet milk product commercial. I said, yes. Why? And he said, because a producer is interested in you. And I said, who? He said, well, why don't you come over to the studio and we'll talk about it. So I went over to the studio, and he wouldn't tell me who it was. Meanwhile, all weekend, I'm put through this suspense thriller. Who is this person? I met about four different executives from Universal. Nobody would tell me who it was. And they asked me to go to a big agency, MCA. And it was there that one of the agents said, there's a producer who wants to sign you to a contract. I said, who? He said, well, if you'll look over the contract and sign it, we will go over and meet Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, my goodness. Lightning struck. Well,
yes.
Tibby, what was he like as a person?
Very complicated. There was the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah.
It was so funny when we went over to meet him. The weekly shows that he did, Hitchcock Presents?
Oh, sure. Sure.
And the very beginning where he's standing with his profile.
Yes.
That's the way he opened the door, and he stood there like that. I mean, it's funny to think of it now.
Well, Tibby, let me ask you about the filming of The Birds. Okay, did they use real birds throughout the whole filming?
They did.
Oh.
And I loved the bird trainer. He was absolutely wonderful with those birds. And he was teaching them all those nasty things to do.
Oh, yeah. So all those birds on those telephone lines, they were all real?
A lot of them were. But then he put fake ones in between so that it looked like more birds than actually were there.
Wow. Okay, then let me ask you, and I still am scared to this day with this scene, and I think you know what I'm going to be talking about.
What, at the end of the film?
At the end of the film, when you go up to the second floor bedroom.
Mm-hmm. And why would I do that?
Why did you go up there?
Well, I asked you, Chuck, after I first read the script. I said, why do I go up there knowing what has happened to everybody in Bodega Bay?
Oh, I know. We're all sitting at home saying, don't go up there, please.
Yeah, well, do you know what he said? He stopped for a moment like he'd never thought of that. And he said, because I tell you to.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, there you go. That's a good answer, I guess, if you're Alfred Hitchcock.
In other words, it's my paycheck, yeah.
Right.
Okay, so then we get to the end of the film, and I said, Mr. Hitchcock, when I open that door and all those birds come flying at me, how would we be doing that scene? And he said, oh, well, we'll be using the mechanical birds like we do when the children are working. Fine. No problem. They all lied to me the entire shoot. And went out to the set, and they had no mechanical bird in sight. They had a cage built around the door that I opened, and there were huge cartons, a raven, a gull, and a few pigeons thrown in, and they hurled them at me for a week.
Oh, were you injured?
A little.
A little?
Yeah, and by Friday, they had the birds tied to me.
Oh.
Very loosely so that they could move. And one of them jumped from my shoulder and really got me way too close to the eye, and I just burst into tears.
I bet. Yeah. Wow. Well, you did such a phenomenal job, obviously, in The Birds, that you landed the key role of Marnie,
yes,
which was a romantic drama and psychological thriller.
Yes.
So that must have been an incredibly challenging role to play.
You know something? I was so thrilled to do that. I had read the book, and it was such a complicated character. It was just absolutely delicious. And I was just so honored to have been given that role. He wanted Grace Kelly to do it. You know, I knew she'd been asked to do it. And I thought, how could the Principality of Monaco let their princess play the role of a thief, a liar, a cheat? I mean, how could they do that? And of course they couldn't.
Well, good for you, right?
Good for me.
Well, Tippi, so which was your favorite role?
Marnie.
Really?
Oh, definitely.
It sounds like it was less dangerous.
Yeah, well, a lot more complicated, though. And I talked to psychiatrists and psychologists, and it was interesting because all of those years ago, they didn't even really think about if a child has a traumatic experience. And if it isn't dealt with on a psychiatric or psychological basis, how it manifests itself later in life.
Oh, I'm sure.
And, you know, the film wasn't a success, though, at that time. It is now. And critics are saying it's his best movie.
Well, Tippi, real quickly, we have to ask you about your passion for animals. Do you live in a cottage on the Shambhala Preserve in California? And you're a real-life den mother. So tell us about that.
I started that in, 1972. I had done two films in Africa, and during those years, environmentalists all over the world were telling us, people of the world, that if we didn't do something right then to save the wild animals, by the year 2000, they would be gone just because of encroaching civilizations, sport hunting and poaching. But anyway, I became very, very much involved with this, and my then husband was a producer, so we thought, let's do a movie about the wild animals, and we chose the lion to be our stars. And we got home, and we had seen a house on the Gorongosa Game Preserve that had flooded during the rainy seasons. And the man moved out, and a pride of lion moved in, into the house.
Wow.
And it grew to be the largest pride in all of Africa. You couldn't even count how many cats. There were over 25. Lions of all sizes. And they were sitting in the windows looking like great portraits. They were going in and out the doors. They were napping on the verandas. There were a couple of lions up on the flat-type roof having an argument, a fight. The cubs were out in front. It was a perfect movie set. So that's the way the script was written. You know, not knowing really about these animals, when we handed the script to the Hollywood trainers of these acting lions, they just came back laughing at us to say, you can't do this movie because of the numbers of cats you have working together. And we said, well, that's what we saw in Africa. And I said, no, it's because of an instinctual dictate to fight a cat they don't know. I don't want my cat hurt. I don't want to get hurt. get your own animals to do the movie. So first one was a little cub, about 9 months old, that we had rescued. And as the little cub grew, they become a one-man demolition crew. And there was no 400-pound mom to say, knock it off. Nor were there any cubs with whom he could play, any little siblings. So the doctor became the sibling, and he didn't like it. He said, somebody please take this monster off of my hands. So we did it. We called him, Melanie named him Casey. He was the first of, in the 80s, we had 150 cats of all different species that we had rescued.
I bet Melanie was very popular at Show and Tell talking about her lion at home.
Oh, you bet she was. You bet she was.
Well, Tippi Hedren, we sure wish we had more time. It has been an honor and a privilege chatting with such an icon.
Well, thank you, but I have to tell you one more thing. Look up my second federal bill. It's titled Big Cats and Public Safety Protection Act. My own congressman has introduced it. It's in committee right now, and we need everybody to write to their congressman. Look us up at Shambhala, shambala.org, and I have why this is so important to get this stop this breeding of lions and tigers, and also sample letters.
Thank you so much, and congrats on all your great efforts in bringing awareness about abandoned and abused exotic animals.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next, Edgar Allan Poe and little-known facts about Abraham Lincoln. Stay with us.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, aunt, son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save...
Your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T. Face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of...
Your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on. Because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Steve Barry is one of the most popular contemporary thriller writers who is also passionate about preserving historic treasures. One of these treasures is the home of the granddaddy of all thriller writers, Edgar Allan Poe, whose home, in fact, will soon reopen to the public. Steve Barry joins us from Florida. Welcome, Steve.
Great to be here.
Steve, what is it about Edgar Allan Poe that you really want to help restore his home? You find it important.
You sort of said it right there. He's like the... You don't want to say the father, but more like the grandfather of the contemporary thriller. He was a writer's writer. He lived a writing life. He worked very hard all his life in the short time that he was here, trying to further his career, trying to make a living as a writer. There's a lot about today that you can identify with him. And then, of course, his life ended, you know, quickly and mysteriously, and it's always had that little air to it. The home in Baltimore has been there for a while. It needs a lot of work, and I'm glad to be part of the inauguration to kick off the restoration and reopening of that home.
You know, there really is nothing quite like reading an Edgar Allan Poe story. I mean, I just think about it, and it still sends chills up my arms. What do you think it is about or was about his writing technique that he was able to really do that to readers?
Well, he found things that were scary, but they were scary to everybody universally. I said it all the time. You know, it's, you know, very few people have a person with a chainsaw coming after them, trying to cut them up in little pieces. That's a very rare, you know, occurrence. But we all have fears: the fears of losing a child, the fears of losing your mind, the fears of a dark corner in a dark place at night. And Poe tapped into that. And he tapped into a fear that everyone could identify with. And it's why he's lasted and stood the test of time.
Well, I can certainly attest to that. I have a real fear of ravens now. Any blackbird will do it for me.
See, just something simple like that, and the way he did it, you know, he was able to tap into the human psyche. And that's tough to do.
Well, let me ask you, as long as we're talking about Poe, too, let me ask you about this little factoid that I heard and get your take on it. I heard that there was a mysterious person known as the Poe Toaster who left 3 roses and a half bottle of cognac at Poe's grave on his birthday, and he did this for many, many years.
That I believe, is a true statement.
Who was this person? Do you have any idea?
No one knows.
Ooh, that even adds to the mystery.
No one really knows, but that is a true thing that actually happened, and we may never know the answer to that question. There's been a lot of speculation, but nobody knows.
Well, Steve, as you just said, that history really is kind of at the heart of each one of your novels. You have a new book coming out, The Lincoln Myth. Can you just give us a quick synopsis, a quick glimpse to the story?
It's Cotton Malone's latest adventure. He's going to get caught up in something very interesting with the Constitution, something that's fascinated me, the question of can a state secede from the Union, secession. It's a very interesting question. And so he gets caught up in this. He also gets caught up with the Mormon Church, which is involved in very much in the story. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had a lot of interesting roles in American history. It's very interesting how they weave into our history, and I've always been fascinated with that. Abraham Lincoln was the first president that we know of to ever read the Book of Mormon. We know that because he checked it out of the Library of Congress and kept it for 8 months. He also made a secret deal with Brigham Young, and that deal helped alter the Civil War. And all of this is going to play into the novel.
And Steve, let me ask you about that fact. So how did you uncover this? How did you realize that even existed?
I did some research on it. I was out in Salt Lake on tour a couple of books ago, and I came across some just listening and asking questions. I came across some interesting information when I was out there. I went back and started doing the research on it, and then I discovered that Lincoln had checked out the Book of Mormon, and then I found the actual deal that he made with Brigham Young. And as I began to put it together, I realized there was a novel there. So it's just a matter of just a little detective work.
Now, do you think if he hadn't made that deal with Brigham Young, do you think that would have changed the course of the war at all?
It's possible it could have, because the deal was rather significant. It involved the West. If Lincoln had lost the West to the South, he most likely would have lost the Civil War. The deal he made with Brigham Young helped secure the West for the North. So it certainly did have it played a factor. And it came at a critical moment, too, because in January of 1863, the North was losing. This is before Gettysburg now. The North was in bad shape at this point. This war was not going well. And the deal that he made was critical in order to help turn the tide.
Wow. Well, another really interesting fact that you kind of uncovered was that in 1862, Lincoln told Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, that he would do whatever it took to preserve the Union, even if it meant not freeing a single slave. That's like driving a dagger in my heart.
We have to understand the Civil War was not fought over slavery. It really had nothing to do with it, to be honest with you. It had nothing to do with it at all. Remember, slavery was constitutional. Slavery was sanctioned by the United States Constitution. So there's no way that the North fought a war to abolish something that the Constitution itself allowed to exist. So that's a fallacy. It's part of the myth that we deal with, the Lincoln myth. It's part of it, this myth. Lincoln did not free a single slave, not one. The Emancipation Proclamation freed no one. The slaves that Lincoln could have actually freed with the Emancipation Proclamation, he exempted from it. So there's another myth there. So the Civil War had little to nothing to do with slavery. It had everything to do with the Union. You got to realize that Lincoln did not fight the Civil War to save the Union. He fought the Civil War to create the Union. He actually created the concept of an indivisible, indissolvable Union that never existed to that point. Now, the question is, was he right? And there's some serious arguments that he was not right.
Wow. Well, finally, Steve, real quickly, we read that you've been asked to write the foreword for the re-releases of James Michener, your hero, you know, his novels, and that is such an honor. So did you personally meet Michener?
I never got to meet him, unfortunately. He died before I was published. He died in 1997, and I never got to actually meet or see him. That was one of my great sorrows. I would love to have met him and told him what he meant, because I collected all of his books. I have a complete collection of them. He is my favorite writer, and when Random House asked me to do that, it was a thrill. And if you go on Amazon now and you type in James Michener, my name comes up with him because they put the Ford writer's name on there too. And it's surreal to me to see my name associated with his. It was just it's an amazing thing.
Well, Steve Barry, best-selling author and historic preservationist, best of luck with your projects and the launch of your new book, The Lincoln Myth. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you so much.
Wouldn't it be great if instead of spending weeks, maybe months planning your next trip, you could just hand the reins over to someone else to make all the arrangements? Not only that, they decide where you should go and keep your destination a total secret until your arrival at the airport.
Well, we recently learned of a company that does all that and more. Magical Mystery Tours is based in Washington, D.C. It's like Amazing Race with a dollop of Match.com thrown in for good measure. Denise Chaikum, president of Magical Mystery Tours, joins us on the phone to tell us how it all works. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, Denise, so tell us how it all works. How do you even start the process?
Well, we try to make it really easy for people. So basically, you go to our website, and on there, we have a survey. And with our survey, you can tell us all about your travel preferences, where you've been, how much you want to spend, when you want to go, things that you don't want to do. Pretty much covers everything about what you want to get out of your trip. And so then from there, we go ahead, work with you if we have any questions, but we go ahead and plan the trip for you. So at that point, you'll know when you're going, but that's about it. Then a week before you leave, you get a weather report from us, and we let you know when you need to show up at the airport. A few days before you leave on your trip, we send you a packet that has all the information, so your hotels, any activities you wanted planned. But we recommend that you don't open that envelope until you get to the airport. So then you go ahead, you head to the airport, you open up that envelope and find out where you're going, and then you're on your way.
Away you
well,
go.
I say you're being very trustworthy of people not opening that envelope.
Well, you know, it's your vacation. So if you are, if you want to cheat and open it early, you're allowed to do that. But honestly, everybody tells us they wait and open it and send us pictures of them at the moment they open it at the airport. So people are pretty good about it.
And that's the whole idea. They want to be surprised.
Of
exactly.
Okay, so Denise, how do you and your staff narrow down all the possibilities to a specific place? Because I assume you've got lots of questions on this questionnaire, mm-hmm. but how do you do that? I mean, just have a big globe you spin and stick your finger on it?
Right. Honestly, you're not that far from it. You know, a lot of times you read a questionnaire from somebody and a destination just comes to mind and you think, I just know this person is going to love France and how they haven't been. And other times, we really literally will pull up Google Maps and you just kind of look at it and you're thinking, what does this person want? Where haven't they been? We really try to send people to new places. More fun that way.
Do you consult with each other about what you think this person would like? Is it a team approach?
It totally depends on the trip. Sometimes you just look at it and you know and you're set. And then other times we kind of, especially when we have travelers who've really been a lot of places, we're like, okay, we need something new. We really need to impress this person. What's going to surprise them? Then we'll all get on a call or something like that and really brainstorm. So it just totally depends.
Now, are all of the trips customized? I mean, in other words, you don't just find a great deal with a tour company and just put your client in a tour, do you?
That's a great question. No, all our trips are customized, and we think that's part of what makes Magical Mystery Tours special. Sure, there's some destinations we like, but even if we're sending somebody to a place that we've sent other travelers, we're usually picking different hotels and different activities, and every traveler's so unique, and once you throw in things like the time of year they're going and properties changing and all that stuff, we really think it just has to be a customized trip.
Well, Denise, what was one of the all-time favorite trips you planned?
Good question. We did a trip last year that was just so exciting to me. It was a couple celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary, and they came to us and said, you know, we haven't really traveled much. We're really excited. We don't even know where to start. Just surprise us. And they were the nicest couple. They were so excited. And we ended up sending them on a tour of Italy. So they hit a bunch of different cities there. And they just absolutely loved it. We had so much fun. We were waking up every morning and they'd send us pictures. Oh, look at the view of Florence today. This is amazing. We ate pizza here and did these things. And, you know, I think a trip like that for people who haven't traveled all that much and we can make that happen for them is just so exciting for us.
Did you ever plan a trip that actually kind of bombed?
And people might have complained a little
bit. That they, well, you know, you sent them someplace, it's sunny and they're allergic to the sun. I don't know.
Or I want to go home.
We had a trip recently where people were leaving from Boston in the winter. You always know that's a little rough with weather concerns. And I think they were planning to go to the Dominican Republic, and they get there, and the one flight that day was canceled. So we regrouped, we talked to them, and ended up finding a great resort in Mexico that they were really excited about. So it took some quick maneuvering there. I mean, we've had some other trips where we're looking at the forecast and you have people going to a beach. And
there's a hurricane coming.
Exactly. So that's the kind of thing we can usually scramble at the last minute and find a better option or something else that'll work. But yeah, weather's not always on our side.
Well, Denise, do you get your clientele from all over the world or are they mostly, you know, from the United States?
People from all over the world, though the vast majority of our customers are Americans, good number of Canadians, but mostly the U.S.
And let me ask you, you're talking about weather conditions. Do you send a packing list before you arrive at the airport so people even know what to put in their suitcase?
We do, yeah. So a week before you leave, you get an email from Magical Mystery Tours with your weather forecast, and then in there we just include if you should remember to bring sneakers or bathing suits or anything like that, that we just want to be extra sure you have there with you.
And I would imagine maybe within that list is instructions about what time to arrive at what airport?
Yes, exactly. So it'll say you want to show up, if it's somebody from D.C., you want to show up at Dulles around 10 a.m. at Terminal 2. So yeah, everybody, so you can plan that. You can plan your transportation to the airport. So all those logistics are covered for you.
And you tell them the airline.
You know what? We don't. We usually just say what terminal. Because, I mean, if you're on British Airways, that kind of gives them a little
give
more
it
I'd be
way.
Googling like crazy. Oh, so, okay. So you make it pretty difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, we've had people who've said, can you give us hints? Things like that. And we're more than happy to do that if you want to know. It's your trip. It's up to you. But we sort of plan it that unless you tell us otherwise, we are going to do our best to make sure you don't know where you're going before you leave.
Okay, so at what point do you give your clients this detailed itinerary with the destination and really put them out of their misery?
Aw, it's not misery. So that's the packet they get in the mail that they open at the airport. And there's a little booklet in there that says, you're going to, and it lists the destination, it tells you about your hotel, gives you some ideas about what you might want to do there. We try to include like a tour guide on that area so you can read up while you're on the plane. But at that point, you know absolutely everything there is to know.
And
about
Denise,
where you're
going. Do you also plan excursions? So say they're taking a little river cruise in Europe or I don't know, or doing something. Do you plan something aside from being at the resort?
Yes. We ask every customer if they want us to sort of build a little itinerary for them or if they just want the basic plans. But then if somebody wants us to plan those extra activities, we send them a secondary survey and they tell us if you want restaurant reservations, what do you like? Do you want spa reservations, sporting events, historical tours, museums, any of that stuff? So they tell us exactly what they want, sort of a budget they have in mind, and then we'll build out any kind of itinerary that you want for your trip.
Well, you must be a very well-traveled professional.
Well, with all of us at Magical Mystery Tours, we've covered a lot of the world. It's a great excuse to keep traveling for us.
Oh, I'm sure. And Denise, we hear you ask in your questionnaire whether, and I love this, travel is about the journey or the destination, which I think is very philosophical. So why is that important to you all at Magical Mystery Tours?
I think there's just a lot of questions we ask that helps us get a feel for what you want out of your vacation. Is it that you ultimately just, you want to be on a gorgeous beach somewhere, getting a suntan with a fancy drink in your hand, or are you someone who is up for something crazy? Do you want to go hike in South America and meet different people? And, you know, some trips are just harder and more complicated and more of a challenge, and that's fun for some people, and some people just want to relax. So it's all about just us trying to figure out what you want out of your vacation and making sure we can match that up for you.
And Denise, do you all get great rates at hotels and airlines that you can pass along to your customers?
Good question. We do. We really try. And actually, I think for a person who's willing to take a mystery tour, we can get really good deals in that if you come to us and say, I want to go to London in June, there's only so much you can do with that. There's certain prices you're dealing with. But when we have flexibility, we can look at your budget and we can look at the options and hopefully find something that's a good deal.
Well, real quickly, what's the best destination for the price now?
Ooh, good question. You know, there's a lot of places in Southeast Asia, so like Thailand, places like that, where you just have a fantastic exchange rate. So I just got back from Thailand last week. It was absolutely amazing. And now the flights there are still a little pricey, but once you're there, if you have time to spend there, you will spend a fraction of what you'd spend at maybe in Hawaii or somewhere like that.
How much advance time do you need to really plan a great trip?
Depends. A lot of people give us usually 6 months or so, but we ask for at least 6 weeks for most trips. That's about where we're comfortable. We don't have to rush too much. More advance notice is great, but once we get closer than 6 weeks, we actually do have rush fees, just because for us to find you a great deal and a great trip just takes a little extra work. So a couple months is about perfect.
Well, Denise Chacom, president of Magical Mystery Tours, what a creative idea. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having me.
Everybody might not be able to say this, but our next guest turned to her husband, a chemist, and said, "Whip me up something to relieve my annoying itch." Mary Ambrose, president of Molecular Solutions, joins us in our studios to share her story. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Mary, so what happened that spurred you on to invent your own solution to your itch problem?
One mosquito bite too many.
Really?
Yes. After living in parts of the country that have incredible bugs, I never had the idea until in D.C., a mosquito bite just put me over the edge. And I turned to my husband and said, "Okay, I'm going to try the meat tenderizer trick that you put on jellyfish stings," which works kind of, but then it dries and it falls off, so it doesn't really work. And we talked about it, and I said, "Is there any reason that you can't put meat tenderizer in lotion and then it would stay on your bite long enough to do something?" And the first question is, what is a meat tenderizer? And we started looking at the bottle and playing around with it, and suddenly it started to make sense.
Did you ever just try hydrocortisone cream?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't
help
at all.
Huh.
No,
huh.
No, it doesn't help at all.
Yeah.
In fact, there was an article in the New York Times talking about itch. And it basically said cortisone creams and antihistamines, all of those things really do nothing for itch problems.
So when you started to develop this cream, what did you do? Sort of mix up batches in your kitchen?
Yes,
really?
Exactly. First, just with lotion off the shelf and ground up bromelain, which is what's in meat tenderizer. But you couldn't tell what you were actually getting. And if you've ever looked at a bottle of hand lotion, there are at least 25 ingredients in it. And you're thinking, well, that's not such a great idea. So then it was on to buying pure bromelain, which you can buy in powder form, then buying base lotion, which also has 25 ingredients in it. And the next thing was go to the kitchen and figure out how to make lotion.
That is amazing. And I have a hard time scrambling an egg. My gosh. Well, Mary, did you do actually some scientific trials? How do you know that it works?
We first tried it on me, obviously, the logical guinea pig, but we got it down to 7 ingredients plus distilled water. So the only things in it really are shea butter and grapeseed oil and the emulsifier. It's all plant-based. And we started sending it out to friends and family, of course, saying, would you try this and then fill out my little form and answer my questions? Send me the form back. Let me know. I guess I mailed out over a period of time probably 200 plus samples to people and to dogs because it works on dogs.
And we want to know that one. How did you discover it would work on a dog? Do you have a dog with an itch problem?
No, but we knew someone who did. And God love him, he took photos before and after of his dog's tummy. And she had this terrible problem. He said, we put it on, and for the first time, we could sleep through the night because the dog wasn't scratching all night.
So did you recruit other dogs for this experiment?
Really?
Yes. Oh, we have a few we could give you.
I'm taking dog volunteers all the time.
Mary, does it work on poison ivy?
It does.
Ooh.
It works on everything it's been tried on to date. I'm waiting for chigger season.
I was just going to say that because
chigger season's coming.
This last weekend, my husband roped me into raking leaves in the yard.
Oh, the nerve.
I know. And do you know what happened? I now have chiggers. So I hope you brought some samples,
Mary.
I did
indeed. And,
oh, good. So, Mary, what are your plans? Are you going to launch your product or what's going to happen next?
Kiss My Itch Goodbye is incorporated in D.C. and the trademark has already been approved by the trademark people.
Wow,
which
that's
was
a big deal.
I have now approval on a provisional patent, so that's taken care of. And the product's for sale on the web. And I am shipping it out every day.
Did you ever think that this might really be sort of your midlife reinvention?
Heavens no. And the challenge for me, having worked in sales pretty much all of my career, I have only sold high-end software, consulting, bodies, i.e. recruiting. I have never sold anything that sells for less than $25.
Oh,
it's a whole new world. I'm just really learning a lot.
Well, as you've sort of gone through this process, is there any advice you would offer someone else who has the next brilliant idea, you know, like you've just had, about how to really navigate the system and how to find a way to take your little product or your invention and get it to market?
I guess you really have to be willing to jump off a cliff. Because you have no idea if it will work if you don't try it.
Well, Mary Ambrose, inventor of Kiss My Itch Goodbye, best of luck on your launch in the product and much success to you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with both of you.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.